Good afternoon. I'm going to call to order this Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology for April 20th, 2017. And we've got an informational meeting. You want to tell us about it?
Certainly. Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee. For today, we've got the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority here with us today to give an information technology overview and also update the committee on the status of the integrated eligibility Medicaid eligibility project. And so if you could please come on up and please remember to introduce yourself for the record before you begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kristen Deuce. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Department of Human Services. With me here today, immediately to my right, is Eric Smith. Eric has recently joined our team as the Independent Project Director for our Integrated Eligibility Project. And to his right is Wayne Haddad, and Wayne is our Business Information Systems Director for the Oregon Health Authority. So on this next slide outlines the presentation topics for today. I'm going to start by giving you an overview of the Office of Information Services. This is the organization that I lead. You may also hear me refer to it as OIS. We're going to talk a little bit about the projects we completed in the last biennium and some of the work that we've done. And then Wayne is going to talk about the two largest systems that we support, the Medicaid Management Information System, or MMIS, and then our newest system, which is called One, and that's our MAGI Eligibility Determination System. And then we're going to move to an update on the Integrated Eligibility Project, what you probably know of as the Integrated Eligibility Project. We're actually going to be renaming this project to the One Integrated Eligibility and Medicaid Eligibility Project. And we'll talk a little bit about why that rename when we get into that part of our presentation. At that point, Wayne Singer is also going to join us at the table, and Wayne is the Deputy Operations Director for the Aging and People with Disabilities Division of the Department of Human Services. Okay, so on this next slide, this gives an overview of the two agencies that we serve. So in case you're not familiar with them, with the Department of Human Services at the top here, I've listed the major program areas for DHS. And at the bottom, the major divisions of the Oregon Health Authority. OIS exists to support the business of the agencies and the missions of safety, health, and independence for all Oregonians, and better health, lower cost, and better care, which is a triple aim. So the staff within the Office of Information Services support over 12,000 agency staff, plus many partners throughout the state. These 12,000 plus staff and partners use over 250 applications and 300 plus technology tools to do their daily jobs, and 23,000 technology devices, which are things like desktops and laptops, tablets, cell phones, and so forth. So OIS is a fairly typical IT shop in the services that we provide. So I'm just going to hit on a couple of them here. First at the top, we have a service desk. We call it the OIS service desk. And we also provide on-site technical support. And we have technicians throughout the entire state in every single county. We assist with business case development with our business partners and also help them in solution analysis and in solution selection. We have a project management office, and we provide project managers and oversee all of the projects for both agencies that have an IT component. And we have a very large application development shop. These folks support those 250 applications and the 300-plus tools that are in use by our customers on a daily basis. And then OIS also has the Information Security and Privacy Program. And this includes policies, education and awareness, risk and vulnerability management, and e-discovery. So we work very closely with the Office of the State CIO. I think that a few weeks ago you heard from the Strategic Technology Officer for the Healthy People Policy Area, that was Ethan Benetan. And he presented the Information Resource Management Plan for this policy area. We worked very closely with Ethan in the creation of this plan. And that plan is what really describes the state of IT currently for OHA and DHS, as well as some of the other boards and commissions in that policy area. We receive most of our server storage and networking needs from the state data center. And we also work closely with the state CIO in the stage gate process for our largest and riskiest of projects. And then last on the slide here, we're active participants in the work that's underway to unify cybersecurity in Oregon. So this next slide shows the operating budget for OIS, which in the 2017-2019 governor's recommended budget is just over $163 million. And actually, this is a limitation. We don't actually have a budget. I just get to spend everybody else's money. So as with most IT shops, the majority of the work that we do is actually around what we call KTLO, or keeping the lights on. And every day, OIS staff are working diligently behind the scenes to make sure that the applications that we support and the devices that we support are stable and secure and meet the day-to-day needs of our customers. As with many IT organizations, often people only call OIS when either something is wrong or they need something. But that's not what we want to be known for. We want to be known for our customer service, for the value that we provide to our customers, and for our ability to deliver IT projects. So I joined the Office of Information Services just over 2.5 years ago, about a year after the Cover Oregon failure. And when I came in, I wasn't quite sure what I was going to find or what the morale of the organization would be. And I was really pleasantly surprised to find that it was just a great group of talented professionals that wanted to learn from the past and to put Cover Oregon behind us. But we knew with this reputation, it wasn't going to be enough for us just to tell you we were doing better. It wasn't going to be enough just to tell our agencies that things were going to be different. We knew that we were going to have to prove it. We're going to have to prove it to the agencies, to you, and to ourselves. We knew that we would have to have data and numbers to tell our story, and that they'd need to be based on industry best practices. And so we got busy. And so in these next three slides, I just want to showcase some of this work for you and point out some of the things that we've been working on. So first of all, on the left-hand side are some very, very small charts. Those aren't meant for you to be able to read. But I did want to show you that as a result of this work, we produced actual products that we use on a day-to-day basis. This just wasn't lip service. This was actually products that we were producing. The very first thing up here is a performance management system that we implemented right after I joined the organization. And this was actually in place. There was a version of this in place when I came in. And so we really just dusted it off and really made it our own. And this is the same framework that you might have seen from other agencies that really gets to identifying the core processes that an organization does. So on a daily basis, what is the work that we do? And then it also allows you to establish measurements to really identify and define whether or not you're doing that work well. So we have set quarterly targets against 25 measurements, and we publish these on what we call our OIS scorecard. That's the second item up there. And every quarter we get together and we review the results for the year, for the quarter, how we did against those targets. And it's actually my absolute favorite meeting of the quarter because it's just a great opportunity to celebrate with staff the progress that we have made and to identify the areas that we need to lean into. And so this has just been a great way for us to make incremental progress towards where we're trying to go. So we're not perfect yet, but at least we've defined our roadmap to get there. So that's what's been great about this process. We're also implementing a standard governance structure to help guide our prioritization and IT investment decisions across both organizations. Okay, on this slide, this shows a few more of those improvement areas that we've been working on. So the first was establishing a project management office. So when I first came into the organization, we did not have a PMO. We knew that if we were going to be able to deliver IT projects successfully, that we needed to have a very standard, repeatable process for doing our projects. So we established our project management office. We have standards for project reporting. We've created a dashboard for all of our major projects, and we share our scope, budget, and schedule to all of our stakeholders. And you'll see a little later in the presentation, we've shared with you our stoplight status for each of our projects. We feel it's very important for us to know where we stand with each of our projects. And we have very strict criteria about what makes a project green, what makes a project yellow, and what makes a project red. And it gives us the ability to know that we're leaning in on the right projects. And then we've also implemented a structured change management and incident management process. And this is not change management as you might think of as organizational change management, which often is about adoption of a system when you implement. This is really about how do we strengthen our practice when we're deploying changes into our production environment. And on the right, you can see I put a few outcomes from some of this work. In 2016, we implemented just over 1,400 changes. And if you do the math, that's about 4 changes every day. On the next slide, shows a few more of the improvement areas that we've been working on. The first one is about streamlining process. So we have really been working to create a culture of continuous improvement, and we're constantly looking for opportunities to streamline our work both within OIS, but also in that interaction with our customer. And one example that we had this year that is outlined on the right-hand side here is an exercise that we did with the Oregon State Hospital. The Oregon State Hospital has a process improvement team, and their lean leaders worked with us on an onboarding project, and we were able to reduce the number of steps in that process collectively by 56%. So both agencies deal with very confidential and sensitive data. And since I started OIS 2.5 years ago, there has not been one single day when we have not been under somebody's audit. So audits, it was very important for me that we were able to get a handle on the audit findings that had been brought to us in the past, but also those that were coming to us throughout the process. And we created in 2015 an audit and risk management program. We call it ARM. And during 2016, we closed 276 open audit findings. Both agencies take security and privacy very seriously, and that starts with education and awareness. In 2015, we implemented a new mandatory annual security and privacy training, and this past year, of the 12,000 DHS and OHA staff, 97% of the staff completed the training. Okay, over the next couple of slides, I want to talk about some of the projects that we completed. During the 2015-2017 biennium, we completed 14 major IT projects. These are projects that were over $1 million. I've highlighted on the next couple of slides 7 of those projects, and I think I'll just talk to a couple of them here, but certainly if you have one that is a favorite project or one you'd like to hear about, happy to talk about that as well. And then you'll hear about the other 7 a little later in the presentation. So on this slide, I thought I'd talk just a minute about the medical marijuana expansion project. So this came about as a result of Senate Bills 3400 and 844 in the 2015 session, and then subsequent bills in 2016 that mandated functionality for intake, storage, tracking, auditing, and reporting of medical marijuana data for growers and producers. We are under very tight timelines for this project, and we were able to complete the work within the timelines and the budget that were allocated. And then on this next slide, again, 4 more of the projects that we completed in 2015 and 2017. And the one I thought I'd highlight here is the very first one, which is the WIC EBT. WIC is the Women, Infant, and Children Program. And EBT is Electronic Benefits Transfer. So this was an exciting project that allowed Oregon to get away from paper vouchers. And we implemented a completely automated process. We all benefit from shorter lines at the grocery store, but certainly the program benefits from being able to spend more time on nutrition education and really getting more visibility into how food dollars are used.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on that last one, does the EBT involve then like swiping a card?
Yes.
Kind of like Oregon Trail or something?
Yes. So we, co-chair Riley, Representative Clem, yes. So we issued over 17,000 cards, like an Oregon Trail card, but EBT card. And so the clients use that that card at the grocery store.
And can I follow up a little bit? Sure. Do you know, is our card issued by the state or do we contract that to another entity? Like I think maybe Oregon Trail is contracted to a bank maybe or somebody.
Yes. Senator Riley, Representative Clem, yes, we contract with an entity to provide the cards.
Okay, just a little more. Okay. So one question that Representative Olson, Andy Olson from Albany, and I have been talking about over the years is the I don't know that it would be as big of a problem here because of the eligibility, but the kind of like an identity theft, or even there were allegations of people selling their Oregon Trail cards and to other people who then would use them. And so we're trying to figure out a way to, you know, get a picture on there or something. But I remember the cost was high to get a photo on there. Do you know if any of that has ever been made more possible, or how it works with these cards in terms of assuring the person who's using it is actually the person who it was issued to?
So, Co-Chair Riley, Representative Clem, I know that there have been some discussions around pictures on the cards. There is a cost involved in that, and I think that looking at the data between the fraud and the costs, I don't think we get the levels of fraud with the WIC cards.
That was always the problem with Oregon Trail.
Yeah.
Yes, it makes you feel better as a policymaker, but do you want to spend this amount of money to get those pictures on there or not?
Exactly. Yep, good question. Okay. So next, Wayne is going to talk to us a little bit about the MMIS, which is our Medicaid Management Information System, and also Juan.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee. My name is Wayne Haddad. I joined OHA on November 29th of 2016 as the Business Information Systems Director, and my background includes 25 years in healthcare and over half of that as a Chief Information Officer. Slide, Eric. I want to give a brief update on the MMIS system, our Oregon Medicaid Management Information System. We use the system to assign benefits to eligible members and enroll them in our CCOs and provide payments to our providers. The system is large and complex. In 2016, we paid over $6.9 billion out in provider payments, including $4.9 in capitation payments to our CCOs. The MMIS system was an area of concern for some of our CCOs and providers in the 2015 and 16 timeframe, and we conducted listening sessions with them to better understand their concerns. The bulk of the issues were due to residual data integrity issues, such as lack of edits on fields like city. So I could type Salem in three different ways. The system would allow me to do that, and it wasn't edit checking that kind of information. So misspellings and so forth occurred, which created some problems. There were also other residual impacts from data integrity-driven concerns or issues with the system. Other requests included assignment of providers in MMIS to the provider assignment from the CCO to the provider. The CCOs, most of them, though, prefer that they do that assignment, not us and not in the MMIS system. So that we did not change. And there were other feedback that we received, such as, why does the system log me out if I've been away from my terminal for X period of time? And there are HIPAA regulations requiring log out because of PHI and that kind of thing. So we, Kristen, met with the CCO CEOs in February, reported out on every item that was captured and the status of it, and we closed all those issues at that point in time. So there are no significant open issues to report today. On this slide, I've got two slides which are going to go through a few of the projects. I'm not going to talk in detail about them, but I would like to just mention a couple of key points. The TMSIS project, we completed phase one of three. We still have some future steps to accomplish there that include developing interfaces and reports for data that's currently not captured or stored in the MMIS system, but CMS is looking for us to provide that information back. And then analyzing and developing processes, interfaces, and reporting for data elements that may not even exist within the agency or the state anywhere. So capturing certain data that we're not capturing today in any of our systems. Those will take several years to come to fruition, and that's where we'll go from here on TMSIS. The ICD-10 project was a huge project. I wasn't here at the time, but I was involved in ICD-10 with my prior employer. There's a roughly 10x increase in the number of codes. between ICD-9 and 10, it's not a one-for-one mapping. So a code that meant one thing on ICD-9 means something totally different on ICD-10. It was a complex upgrade from both a systems and a human training perspective. On this slide, we did make a significant infrastructure refresh. It updated the capacity of our systems, the performance of our systems, and some of our software, such as the operating systems and database engine. We also implemented disaster recovery through the Hewlett-Packard Enterprises site in Colorado. We replicate our data there on a daily basis, and in the event of a disaster, we're prepared to restore operations very quickly in that facility. And then 5010 was another upgrade that we had to do. It was for ANSI 837 transaction sets, and it was a prerequisite to ICD-10, so that was accomplished here as well. Just a quick spin through those things. Thank you.
And that leads us, if I may, Co-Chair Riley, Eric Smith. I am the Independent Project Director for the One Integrated Eligibility, Medicaid Eligibility Project for OHA and DHS. And I came to the project part-time. I started transitioning early April. This is my first week full-time on the project. I was at the Department of Revenue, as I've worked with a couple of you in that role, led their transformation effort for several years, and I was invited to join this project team. I'm honored to be here, and so I don't have the history, and some of what we want to share is going to require a team to be here today, so I'll help you allow that, and if I could ask Nate Singer to come up and join us. What we hope to go over briefly with you this afternoon is a brief history of the project, and then of interest is probably the events of the last 6 months of what's been going on the project since last September. Because of those events, which we'll be discussing soon, we'll talk about some changes to the scope, schedule, and budget on the project, and then I'll close with some of the current challenges and opportunities that I see in our go-forward process. And so with that, I'll turn it back over to to Wayne.
Thank you. We knew from the onset that the system would be implemented with base functionality. We were driven by converting off of the Cover Oregon platform. It was a court order to complete that within a specific time frame. And we did implement and went live in December of 2015. Some of the facts that surrounded that, we found it near the end of the implementation that we were not able to convert the data, and we had to manually re-enter data, so that created some additional time. I think our application processing went from roughly 8 minutes on the prior system to 40 minutes on the new system, much of it around getting the data entered for the first time. And a lot of that has been accomplished over the past year or 15 months as we've gone through the redetermination cycle for this membership. There was also a significant increase in the membership, as you're aware, with the growth of the Affordable Care Act and the MAGI Medicaid population. We did have to staff up for these activities and some manual workarounds, but we've been able to reduce our staffing as we've implemented the enhancements to the system and completed most of that initial cycle of eligibility redeterminations. We've made many enhancements so far on the system since it went live roughly a year and probably 16 months ago, and we've got other significant ones to continue. They will continue through the course of this year, and then we'll basically stop investing in this system, and these enhancements will be migrated to the upgraded One system, which we'll talk about. Thank you.
Okay, so with this slide, I want to give a little bit of history of how we got from Cover Oregon to where we are today. And this is a complicated journey, and I'm going to make an attempt to simplify it. So I may breeze over a few points and simplify a few things. So certainly if you have any questions, feel free to ask. I'm going to start by talking about how we got to One, so to the MAGI eligibility system that Wayne just described. So the Affordable Care Act allowed Oregon to expand its Medicaid population to cover individuals that were not previously eligible for Medicaid. And this population of folks is known as the MAGI population, and that stands for Modified Adjusted Gross Income. So primarily their eligibility was determined based on their their income. The original vision of Oregon, of Cover Oregon, was that this, that we would provide an eligibility system that would do the eligibility determinations for this population of folks, and that it would also be the system that would be used for individuals, Oregonians, and small businesses to be able to purchase health insurance at federally subsidized rates. So we were going to do a state-based exchange. So Cover Oregon would be the single entry portal for those two activities. When the Cover Oregon system failed in the fall of 2013, Oregon stood up a processing center, and hundreds of workers came together to process paper applications manually. In 2014, Oregon made the decision to close the state-run exchange and adopt the federal healthcare.gov. So we moved to the federal exchange. So at this time, we still had a need to do the eligibility determination for the MAGI population, and so that was then the vision for the one system. We stood up the MAGI eligibility determination project, and in the course of the coming year, we implemented one. I think it's important to talk a little bit about the complexity of one. One is a system that utilizes over 400 virtual servers and consists of 33 COTS products. I think it's also important to reemphasize three key principles that we used throughout that project, and Wayne alluded to these, but I really want to emphasize them. First of all, we knew from the very beginning that we were going to have a very tight timeline. We had a court order to get off of the existing system, the Cover Oregon system, and in a year, and so we had a very tight timeline. We knew we were going to have to scope the system to just be a base product. Knowing that, we also stood up another project that would start after the implementation of one that we call One ESS, or One Enhancements. And Wayne talked about that. Over this last year, we've been enhancing the system. So we knew at the beginning we were going to have to implement a base system. We also knew that as Wayne talked about, that we were not going to be able to convert the data. The data in the Cover Oregon system, we had a lot of data integrity issues. We were very hesitant about bringing over that data, knowing that we would live with data integrity issues for a long time in the future. So the decision by the Executive Steering Committee was made early on to not do a data conversion. We knew that the burden of that decision was going to fall on the workers. The workers would then have to, for the first year, as Wayne mentioned, they were going to have to, at each redetermination, enter the application from scratch. It was a very difficult decision, but I think that in the end allowed us to get to cleaner data quicker. The other decision that was made, or the other principle that was adopted by the business, was to change business practices and to change as little of technology as possible. So we were transferring in a system from Kentucky. The system worked in Kentucky. We were going to try and use the system as much as possible and make as few technology changes as we could. So that's how we got to one. As I mentioned before, we spun up a project at the end of the warranty period after we implemented in December of 2015 called One Enhancements, or ESS. That would add the additional features and functionalities and address many of the known workarounds that we knew we went into production with. So about that same time, our partners at CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, offered the opportunity to extend what they call the A87 cost allocation exception. So what this is that for years we've been able to get 90-10 funding for Medicaid-related systems, development and implementation for Medicaid systems. The A87 cost allocation exception was implemented in 2015 originally, and that gave states the ability, through the enhancements they are making for the Affordable Care Act, to be able to bring in other program areas, so non-Medicaid program areas, into their projects and avoid the cost allocation requirement. So without that exception, they would have had to cost allocate against the different match rates. So this gave states the ability to use 90-10 funding, not just for Medicaid, but the other programs. In July of 2015, CMS announced a three-year extension to the A87 exception, giving us the ability to continue to use that cost allocation exception through the December of 2018. So for Oregon, this means that we would be able, that this meant that we would be able to spin up the Integrated Eligibility Project, now the IEME project, to be able to bring on those additional program areas, SNAP, TANF, ERDC, and non-MAGI, and we'd be able to use the enhanced funding. So that's kind of a very complicated description of how we got from Cover Oregon to where we are today. Okay. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Nate.
Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nathan Singer. I'm the Aging People Disabilities Deputy Operations Director, and I've spent the last couple of years supporting the Integrated Eligibility Medicaid Eligibility Project as one of their business directors. Want to give you just a quick update about what the purpose of what we're trying to accomplish when we're looking at the Integrated Eligibility Project and when we're looking at trying to accomplish through this. Our goal and vision for Oregon is what I call something that's simply complex, which means we have a simple idea that's way more complex to actually introduce, as many of our ideas normally are. So our goal with this is to take all of our financial eligibility and put them into a single system. So take the financial eligibility for our modified adjusted gross income Medicaid, our non-MAGI, so non-Medicaid adjusted gross income Medicaid, or classic Medicaid as some people refer to it, our supplemental nutrition for assistance, SNAP program. Let's try this again. Supplemental nutrition assistance programs, our temporary assistance for needy family, TANF, and our child care programs, and put in a single system. And what that actually allows us to do is to really have improved, simplified access for Oregonians and more efficient and effective services and that are more accurate. Ultimately, I want to just touch on a couple quick points around this. Outside of what you see there, I've spent 10 years working for the Department of Human Services. Most of my time, I spent the first 4 years actually in Eastern Oregon working directly with consumers or clients or members. As Kristen mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, our goal with the services we provide here is to really help Oregonians be able to access their services. Currently, the services that we describe to be in here serve over a quarter of all Oregonians. So over a quarter of all Oregonians access one or more of these services. I say one and more because over 60% of those individuals accessing access more than one service. With our food stamps program, which is SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, I'm just doing that so I can make sure I say it appropriately next time, and Medicaid being the largest overlap of those benefits. Currently today, if an individual has to apply or provide updates for those programs, they have to go to multiple locations and provide oftentimes the same information multiple times. So Oregonians have to do that today. What this platform allows is for Oregonians to really be able to go to a single system or have a single system for us to be able to process that information, allowing for that greater accuracy and hopefully greater efficiency and for the consumer, that effectiveness of really what they're getting for a benefit. So that's the vision that we have. Now where we've gone, that's a discussion that we will catch you up on.
So concurrent with this IEME project being initiated, OHA was heavily involved in the implementation and stabilization of the one system for the MAGI Medicaid population. And we were focused on stabilizing the system, completing Medicaid eligibility determinations correctly and in a timely fashion, as well as developing significant manual workarounds, defining system enhancements, and working to reduce the application backlog and improve the turnaround time.
At the same time, the Department of Human Services was moving forward with this project. As you've heard, there was an opportunity to use enhanced funding that the department was going after and making sure that we could meet those deadlines. It's a large, complex project. We were working through the complexities of those items and really trying to understand what we were going to accomplish. So the Department of Human Services, during this period of time, we're meeting with and working with our system implementation vendor, Deloitte, and we're having sessions. And through those sessions, we started to understand the complexities of the system required the Oregon Health Authority to be more involved than we understood they would have to be involved. From my perspective, we were taking a transfer solution and trying to find ways to break it to meet our stance and how we serve Oregonians today. And because of that, we had to pull back and have some discussions about how we were doing things and what we were really trying to accomplish with this system.
So So this situation that we've described at a fairly high level required some significant energy and problem solving by the leadership of OHA and DHS. The teams met, they addressed these challenges and were able to work through them in a productive manner. I believe the most important decision we had to make was how we were going to perform Magi Medicaid eligibility going forward. We wanted to ensure that we were doing it in a manner that was as consistent as possible with the system design as we could. And that led us through a process of steps of engaging, having difficult discussions and problem-solving sessions, engaging the Coraggio group to assist with some of the final decisions that need to be made. Our agency directors, Clyde Psyche and Lynn Saxon, reached agreement on how we were going to move forward. We incorporated or captured that in the memorandum of understanding that was created between both agencies. And the key things that were delivered out of that, one was a effective governance model, and two, and I think most importantly, was the delegation of Magi Medicaid eligibility determination from OHA to DHS so it could be combined with all the other program eligibility work that's being done in DHS. And that met the model of the state where the transfer system was originally created, so it conformed better with how the system was architected and intended to be used, and helps to minimize the amount of change that's required in Oregon to implement the system and expand it for those programs.
And so, thus, the change in the name for the project. So we made the decision at this point that we would rename the project the One Integrated Eligibility Medicaid Eligibility Project. So One, to emphasize that we're using the same system as we had implemented last year. We're just enhancing it and upgrading it to still be the one system for integrated eligibility, plus we're adding in the Medicaid eligibility with the transfer from OHA to DHS. So this question, has the scope changed? I guess my answer is yes and no. So the system, the technology system that we're getting is still one. It's still the transfer system from Kentucky based on their system called Benefind. There will be some changes to that system as a result of the decision for DHS to do all of the Medicaid determinations. So there'll be a few changes in that regard. I think what has changed certainly is bringing in the integrated service model. So our focus on that, we're now going to be doing the eligibility determinations through DHS through a little bit different service model. We also learned a lot through the fit, gap, and design sessions as we went through this process. So a year, 2 years ago, as we came to each of our major milestones and we looked at the schedule and we looked at the budget, things changed. And at this point, we have that change again. So what we have learned over the last year is that the impact to our legacy systems is of much greater magnitude and complexity than we ever thought. So when we first went into this, we hadn't had the opportunity to really sit through those design sessions and really understand from our system integrator what the extent of the changes would be needed and the functionality that would be pulled out of our legacy systems. So the impact to those legacy systems is a much greater lift. We also recognize that the ability to make those changes to the legacy systems was going to be beyond the capacity of Office of Information Services, my organization, on our own. We really were going to need the help of our systems integrator, Deloitte, to help us with that. They had the knowledge on the one side and that system side. We have the subject matter experts on the legacy side. We are really going to need to partner together to figure out what those changes would need to be. And then I mentioned also the data conversion. We're going to be bringing data in from, if we do data conversion, I think we still have to make some of those decisions, but bringing data in from four separate legacy systems is going to be very complex. It's back to the same decision we had to make in the previous implementation of one, to convert or not to convert. Either way is a very difficult and very complex decision.
So to reinforce some of the things that caused the schedule to extend, You know, we've looked at several things. One, we've been through a fit gap and we've been through design sessions now. We understand more about what we're actually bringing in, what it would take to actually do this work. We also talked to a number of states. Personally, I've talked to over 20 states and talked to their programs that have implemented similar versions or types of integrated eligibility systems. And we looked at the lessons learned from those states, things that worked well for them as well as things that they weren't expecting or things that caused problems for them as they implemented the systems. We also understand more about what our policies are and what's in the transfer solution. So as we looked at Kentucky's rules and policies, we look at Oregon's rules and policies. While we're trying to accept and move as much as we can to what's in the transfer solution, there's some things that we read the rules of federal regulations and feel that our rules align more closely to those, or are things that we feel are the better way to serve Oregonians versus how the transfer solution. Again, those are minimal changes that we look at and try to look around, but those are things we better understand at this point. We also have spent a lot of time understanding what the Oregon Health Authority went through with implementation of one, where they saw opportunities and want some of the pain points that they experienced in actually implementing and rolling out that system. And through those lessons learned, we've looked at the totality of our schedule and made key areas of increases. We looked at our schedule around testing, and specifically really around the implementation of the system and how we can make sure that we have a timeline that allows us the best opportunity to be successful and provide a quality system for Oregonians. So from that and an increased schedule, how much more is this going to cost? There are two slides that I'm going to take you through here today, and I want to be able to cover the areas of cost. The first one today is talking about the different phases of costs that have been talked or discussed with this project. The first phase is the Stage Gate 2 phase. At Stage Gate 2, the department at this point is really still sizing, understanding what's occurred around the project. At that time, we assumed the cost of the project would be $126.1 million. It was assumed that it would be at an 85-15 rate, which is 85% funded by the federal government and 15% funded by state funds. At Stage Gate 3, that increased. The increase of that was around 40%, and the costs in there include a couple things. The number you see here is $177 million. That has one-time costs of about $163 million for the development, design, and implementation, as well as $14 million in ongoing costs for maintenance and operation of the system. The increase there was really around going through the fit gap activity. While going through that activity, we understood more about what Deloitte as a system integrator would actually have to do for the systems. We understand a lot more about what staffing we needed to do around the systems, what it would take for us to really bring that on. And we understood more around what the ongoing maintenance and operation of the system would require. And so those costs were increased there. Normally at Stage Gate 3, you expect a plus or minus of 10%. So our goal and expectations are at that point to understand our budget and really have a plus or minus of 10%. What you'll see here in the following column, in the next slide I'll go into details around this number, is what we project for the current total cost of the project. That's cost expended thus far and cost to finish the project in this next biennium. That increase is $240 million, and we see several reasons for that increase. So on this slide here, it has what was in the original Policy Option Acts and was in GRB for this current biennium. That's the first column, that's original POP request. The highlighted column there is the current request. These are the updated funds, and then we have the difference for you. I'd like to briefly just cover what the differences are in each of those categories and then some of the key drivers for that for you all. At any point, I know this is a lot of budget, a lot of numbers and things there. If you have questions, please let me know. So as total funds, we saw an increase from 142 to 206 million. That's a $63 million increase. I will go over to some of the key drivers in a minute here. But as a total, you saw an increase in federal funds about $45 million, $46 million. Saw an increase in state bonds of $27.4 million. The need for general fund actually went down for DDI activities by $5.3 million. The main reason for that is maintenance and operation activities that we aren't allowed to bond won't be done during this biennium at the same level. And then other fund limitations currently not listed there. These are just other fund limitation allows us to pay for the activities of a shared service, and those calculations are still being done. So that's where we take general fund, and in order to use it in another part of the department transfer there, we need the limitation or authority to actually do that work. And then we have debt services. Debt services increased by $6.15 million because of the increased ask around bonding. So what are the drivers that are really pushing for this increase? First off, one of the things that we discovered with extending the schedule out there is that you have to extend DDI activities. These activities are more expensive. So as a whole, as you look at those costs, there's about $34 million of the $63 million increase that's around professional services for that extension of time. That would be work that's done in order to allow for maintenance and operation that has to happen throughout the implementation period of time, as well as additional time for DDI activities to support a longer rollout and additional testing. You have including a 10% contingency for the project. The Legislative Fiscal Office, other industry standards are really 10 to 15% for contingency funds for a project. In our budget that was originally brought from the department, it was 6%. Thus, you see a $13 million increase to really reach that minimum standard of the 10% that's suggested in there. We've incorporated that into our projections on the budget. There's also additional cost allocation. In any department or across it, the costs associated with a project to have other services such as our financial services, HR, other things get billed against a project. There were no costs that had been built into the original budget for these activities. That cost is $5 million estimated for the effects of those entities being able to bill against the work they're doing to support the project. So we included that in there. Increased staffing because of underestimating or underestimation of the needs for services around the project itself, implementation of the project, support for legacy work on our mainframe systems and moving those up and making sure they work with the new system, and disaster recovery work is about $11 million for an increase. Overall, there is some shift to state funds as well. As Kristen mentioned, there's this exception that goes through December 31st, 2018. At the point that ends, we expect our federal match to change from currently at 84-16 to what we assume at this point to be about 69% federal funds, 31% general fund. That shift has a shift of about $9 to $9.5 million from what would have been federal funds to state funds for that same period of time. These are really the key cost drivers that saw an increase, that additional time frame for it, and making sure that ultimately we deliver something that we can deliver and a quality that will work for us and work for Oregonians.
So as we wrap up our presentation for the IEME project, I want to just go over just a few challenges that we're seeing. Some of them we've already discussed. I'd say one that's not on the slide, though, as I step into this, is when you reset your scope and your schedule and your budget, you need to reestablish just the project management process. And so we've been fortunate, and I've learned a lot quickly from our oversight partners at LFO, the Office of the State CIO, as well as our QA vendor, as we go back and go through the process of redetermining our schedule and our budget. And so that's one thing we're doing right now. It's going through our own process. We have a document that does an impact assessment, options analysis, go forward recommendation that we'll take to the steering committee next week that talks about the impacts to the scope, schedule, and budget, as well as a risk assessment. That'll help us to get back to the foundational documents that we need to revise, and we have a schedule for what documents we think we need to revise and when. So at the heart of this, to manage a project of this complexity and of this scope, is to make sure that it's being managed well, and when you have a pause like we had, we're having to go back and reassess that, and we're in the process of doing that. That's been in the process actually at the request of the oversight body since January and February. So I'm stepping into that as it's just about ready to conclude. As you've heard, this is a transfer system, and my experience as I've worked with you on the revenue project, that was a cost solution. With a transfer system, there's just a bit more complexity, and then the two agencies that are working together on this, aligning their business and operations into one way of providing the services, there are a lot of moving pieces. And the one thing I just want to make sure this committee understands is the estimates that we've shared with you today with regard to cost and scope are our level best estimates based on what we know today, and we're being as transparent as we can be. But in a transfer system, you don't know what you don't know. And it's my commitment to you and our commitment to you that as we learn, as we go, we will come back. We've done everything we can to put everything we can think of on the table today in the schedule and the cost estimates we've given you. But there's just more to learn as we go down this path. If you look at the challenges that I have presented here, we've talked about data conversion and the integrated service model. One of the other things I'm keeping a keen eye is the people impact. And it's not just about people learning how to use a new system. It's about, are the people going to be ready to do a new job? Their work is going to change in many cases. And so one of the things that I benefited from at Revenue was a very strong organizational change leadership process. And I know that our organizations have a very high value on that too. And so that's something that's front and center on my radar, is to make sure we also do everything we can to make sure the people are ready for the system that we will be deploying. The other is, as Kristen highlighted through the different projects that are in play, is there is a high demand often for the same amount of the same people, the same expertise in the organization. And so I know Kristen is working with leadership. I'm working with leadership to make sure that we prioritize our work to make sure that we have the resources that are necessary for this project to be successful. I have a commitment from both agency directors that this project will be resourced to the level it needs to be resourced for it to be successful. And that means we're going to have to continue to monitor that through our governance processes and make sure that we're prioritizing our work so that we can resource it to the best of our ability. Other things that are looming, as you're very well aware being in this building, are the budget cuts. And to be very candid, one of the things I'm watching is PERS reform. There's a real danger of brain drain depending on what happens with PERS reform and what people are having to make personal decisions to do, whether they stay working for the state or not. So there are a lot of extenuating circumstances that are just going to be in play, and I hope you can see I'm going to always be transparent with you about what we see those to be. Federal issues, I mean, there are changes in Washington, D.C. going on that we're keeping an eye on as well that may or may not have an impact over the next 2 years as we go through this project. And then finally, working with Kristen and her staff to make sure that our project management office is adequately staffed to handle not only the work of managing the project, but the demands of the oversight, which is very important and necessary to have transparency into the project. And I would imagine that given these, you're probably wondering, and I know you're going to wrap up because you've got a floor session, what is it that's going to help us to be successful? And I would say that there is a one system in place that's working. We're continuing to modify it. The solution, the systems integrator, Deloitte, is working well with the staff. There's an operating strategy in place now. The fact that OHA and DHS were able to work through what they worked through the last several months shows, I think, a strong commitment to figure out the difficult things that need to be figured out to be successful. And then the knowledge of the people on the project and the oversight. I think there's a lot to build on to be successful, but it's a complex project. Lastly, I would just say go forward. As I mentioned, we're going to be working on our process. We're here today. We know we need to get in front of the Human Services Ways and Means Subcommittee soon. And I think that's, with consideration to the time, the end of our presentation on the IEME update.
Any questions about this presentation? Yes, Senator Boer.
Who has a floor session?
Who has?
He said we had a floor session. You guys have a floor session?
Yes,
at three?
Over there.
Yeah, at 2 o'clock.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just in continuing, we are spending a fortune on computer stuff and way behind the curve. I mean, it's almost as important as our buildings today is to keep them up. Are you working with Dr. Pettit, I assume, on this whole thing? And the 25% overrun has me concerned, especially after the last fiasco we went through. So, you know, we really need, with the budget we have, even though the feds are paying a good portion of this, to see where we can make savings and how much you can return. And I assume we're using some off-the-shelf products and then having to adapt them.
Senator Riley, Senator DeBoer, the off-the-shelf products within the system, but the system is a transfer system that Deloitte built for Kentucky. But there are, as I mentioned earlier, 33 COTS products within that system are utilized. So, for instance, an enterprise service bus, identity and access management product, and so forth.
Do we go to outside vendors to help in some of this?
Senator Riley, Senator DeBoer, the our system integrator, Deloitte, is the outside vendor that we're utilizing for the products, for the project. So it's their staff that are doing the integration.
And my understanding is it was Deloitte that put this together for Kentucky in the first place. So we're using the same integrator for our system as they used for theirs.
Senator Riley, that is correct.
So that helps. One of the things that concerns me is the data conversion effort from our legacy systems into the one system. Are all of those legacy systems being integrated at the same time, or are we doing them one at a time? How are we doing that?
Co-Chair Riley, they will all be done at the same time, and we are looking at what our data conversion strategy will be right now. Certainly, we'll want to take a look at what the data looks like in those systems. We know we have good data in one, so that's a big help because that's the base system, and so we'll look at the other systems from which we'll be bringing data in. So, for instance, the TANF, SNAP, ERDC systems.
Do those systems all use the same key, or that's really a driver?
Senator Riley, yes. We do use what we call a prime number, and we have a translation of that number across those systems. So that is correct.
Good. Yes.
Thank you again, Chair. We tend to regulate a lot through our legislative. I urge you, as you're going into these systems, to try to standardize and what you need out of either the Senate or the House. I'm sure that off session you'll make it's probably easier for us to change how we do it than change the software, especially when future changes come. So I urge you to keep telling us what we need to change rather than just keeping the so-called squirrel in a cage, I guess. So thank you.
Thank you.
So I understand that you have another presentation, but I think we're not going to do that one today. I think we're going to wrap up with this system, with this presentation. And so I thank you very much for coming in and giving this presentation, and I'm looking forward to seeing more information coming from you. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, at this point, we don't yet know, as was alluded to by the presenters, when the Human Services Subcommittee, the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, will meet on this project. That said, it is entirely possible we might bring the agency back for another update on this project prior to the end of the legislative session. In regard to the last portion of the presentation that was planned, there are about 10 or so slides that list in more detail current projects that the agency is undertaking and some of the policy option packages that were not mentioned, not discussed in the earlier part of the presentation. There's a list of those and a description of those. So please feel free to take a look at that information if it's of interest to you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to end this way. Thank you very much.
So are we under quorum committee? I mean, are we under quorum committee? I mean,